the most eclectic audience on radio, only on the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
Now, if you have any views on that Shark Tank episode, please share them. I want to make a point about China by looking at Cuba. And again, this is balancing. What I'm talking about right now is how do you balance individual interest versus a collective solidarity, maybe. All communist and socialist countries are wrestling with this. A lot of the Muslim world is as well. How do you motivate people to do things in business when you take away certain forms of motivation, including the profit motive? So Cuba, I've written about Cuba at length at blackelectorate.com. But to make my point about what's so interesting about China, let me make a point about Cuba. This is from, I believe, the BBC last week news report on some of the reforms going on in Cuba. All of you Cuba lovers, I'm a Cuba lover part-time, but I'm also an economist, and I do know that they're going to have to change some things in Cuba. So we can talk about socialism and capitalism a little bit later. I do plan on seeing Michael Moore's movie. I haven't seen it yet. Hopefully this weekend I'll get around to it. Here's the story from the BBC on Cuba.
Cuba is opening up to market forces and redistributing land. It's the biggest development of its kind since Fidel Castro's revolution in 1959. His brother, President Raul, has begun leasing millions of acres of unused state land to private farmers. The hope is to increase food production and reduce imports. The BBC's Michael Voss reports now from the central province of Camagüey.
Fresh lettuce at the height of summer is a rarity in Cuba, but this small family farm is working hard to meet demand. It's part of a cooperative made up of individual smallholders who club together for credit and supplies. Private farmers own less than a third of the land, but produce almost three-quarters of the island's food. In the past, this private sector was tolerated. Now it's being actively encouraged.
There's been an enormous difference in the last 2 years. They're paying a lot more attention to us. They've helped with irrigation as well as offering more land. Now we earn more money because we're selling more food.
Jorge Alcides is a new member of the cooperative. His family farm has a mix of dairy, cattle and crops, all of it on disused land which 2 years ago belonged to a state farm. It's part of an extra 120 hectares which the co-op has acquired, all of it though in need of attention. Cuba's large state-run collective farms have allowed vast tracts of fertile land to go to waste, much of it covered by a dense weed called marabou. It's like a jungle in here. Once the marabou takes hold, nothing else will grow and the cattle can't graze. And it's a nightmare to get rid of. So far, 80,000 Cubans have been given tracts of land to clear, the first phase of a 2 million hectare transfer. The state is also starting to help with access to fuel, tractors and bulldozers. But much of the work must still be done by hand. It's one reason why the authorities have turned to private farmers to take on the task.
Now I'm happy working. It's different when you do it for yourself rather than being paid a wage.
When Raul Castro took over the presidency from his brother Fidel, there was speculation that he might introduce Chinese-style market reforms. These changes in agriculture, though, are his only major move so far. But the more that private farmers are seen to be boosting their earnings by increasing production, the greater the pressure for similar changes to the rest of the economy as well. Michael Voss, BBC News, Camagüey Province, Cuba.
This is big. Big. The BBC report asked the question, is Cuba making China-style reforms? Well, what kind of economy had Cuba already laid out if it didn't have the Chinese model? I have to be honest. I'm going to probably have to hang out with a bunch of socialists at a coffee shop somewhere in Manhattan, San Francisco, the Bay Area, the lower west, upper or lower west side of Manhattan, or parts of D.C., maybe Adams Morgan. I haven't been able to get a good conversation with a socialist. I mean, a real one. I mean, I want to get a real good. I'm down with Karl Marx. I've read Capital, Socialist. I want to build with that kind of a person, because there's a difference between the kind of communism or socialism that the Soviet Union embraced, that China embraced, and that Cuba embraced. And what some people who romanticize about China, I mean Cuba, don't want to deal with is the fact that it was not just Castro or Che Guevara who designed the Cuban economy. It was Czechoslovakian economists. They were part of the power behind the throne in shaping Cuba's economy. They made a lot of mistakes. The Czech economists made a lot of mistakes. These are the folks that Fidel relied upon. I'm going to get into an example of the difference between the Chinese version, the Chinese economic model in honor of their 60th anniversary, and the Soviet model. Again, listen to the report. I'm going to play it one more time. They're trying to figure out a way how to get more productivity out of the land in Cuba. So they're trying to figure out how to motivate individual Cuban farmers. They're trying to incentivize individual activity. They're trying to prick individual self-interest. One more time, BBC.
Cuba is opening up to market forces and redistributing land. It's the biggest development of its kind since Fidel Castro's revolution in 1959. His brother, President Raul, has begun leasing millions of acres of unused state land to private farmers. The hope is to increase food production and reduce imports. The BBC's Michael Voss reports now from the central province of Camagüey.
Fresh lettuce at the height of summer is a rarity in Cuba, but this small family farm is working hard to meet demand. It's part of a cooperative made up of individual smallholders who club together for credit and supplies. Private farmers own less than a third of the land, but produce almost three-quarters of the island's food. In the past, this private sector was tolerated. Now it's being actively encouraged.
There's been an enormous difference in the last 2 years. They're paying a lot more attention to us. They've helped with irrigation as well as offering more land. Now we earn more money because we're selling more food.
Jorge Alcides is a new member of the cooperative. His family farm has a mix of dairy, cattle and crops, all of it on disused land which 2 years ago belonged to a state farm. It's part of an extra 120 hectares which the co-op has acquired, all of it though in need of attention. Cuba's large state-run collective farms have allowed vast tracts of fertile land to go to waste, much of it covered by a dense weed called marabou. It's like a jungle in here. Once the marabou takes hold, nothing else will grow and the cattle can't graze. And it's a nightmare to get rid of. So far, 80,000 Cubans have been given tracts of land to clear, the first phase of a 2 million hectare transfer. The state is also starting to help with access to fuel, tractors and bulldozers.
Okay, listen now to what he's saying. What is this really all about?
Much of the work must still be done by hand. It's one reason why the authorities have turned to private farmers to take on the task.
Now I'm happy working. It's different when you do it for yourself rather than being paid a wage.
When Raul Castro took over the presidency from his brother Fidel, there was speculation that he might introduce Chinese-style market reforms. These changes in agriculture, though, are his only major move so far. But the more that private farmers are seen to be boosting their earnings by increasing production, the greater the pressure for similar changes to the rest of the economy as well. Michael Voss, BBC News, Camagüey Province, Cuba.
Cedric Mahomet, Black Coffee Program. What are Chinese-style reforms? Huh? What are they? I know I got some real staunch, strong socialist communists out there. I want to build with you. I want to share something with you from someone who's a mentor to me in many ways. A book I do recommend a lot on economic matters. Jude Winiski wrote the book, The Way the World Works. Excellent book. Those of you that know, Jude passed away in 2005. Let me put Jude's picture up. Is that coming through okay? Let me even it out. Jude Winiski. What are the Chinese style reforms? Let me read from The Way the World Works, his classic book. Now you can, the reason why I don't get into the labels of capitalism, socialism, even Islamic economics, that kind of terminology, is because most people don't really know what they're saying. And they act like certain economic systems don't have common elements. There's common elements in every economic system, whether it's socialism, communist, capitalist. I can show you the common element. One of them is, how do you balance individual self-interest with collective goals? That's the tension that exists in every single economic system. This is why I wrote a book on entrepreneurship. I mean, we had to get to the root of individual self-interest. What motivates it? Is it contradictory or not in harmony with collective interests? I personally don't think you can have national economic development until you have entrepreneurial activity. I believe that entrepreneurship is a subset of business, and business is a subset of economics, which is all political. So here is some of what Jude wrote that's relevant. Listen up closely, please. So it says, Jude writes, the Marxian idea, to Karl Marx, does not concern itself with economic growth, but with economic contraction, a perfect counterpoint to Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which represents a growth and not a contraction model. Beneath the sarcasm and rage of Capital and the Communist Manifesto, there is an undeniable admiration for the efficiency of the laissez-faire growth model. Indeed, it is super-efficiency that flaws capitalism in Marx's view. The system is so efficient that it overproduces, which means there must be periodic crashes and contractions in order to restore equilibrium. The masses take the brunt of the contraction. They ultimately must react politically to defend themselves against this cycle of pleasure and pain. The proletariat takes matters into its own hands, if only to smooth out the cycle and distribute both the pleasure and the pain more equally among all the classes. The Marxian model, as a result, approaches the task of designing a system of political economy with a fixation on contraction. In constructing a framework, the first objective is to minimize the painfulness of contraction. Only as a second order of business does it look at expansion. Now listen, here's the point. Here's the root of what I want to focus on and why I wrote my book. But in the first order, the Marxian model commits itself to submerging individualism into collectivism. For it is the untrammeled individual who is viewed as the driving force, or driving the capitalist system towards overproduction, boom and bust. Now I'm getting to why there are certain black progressives who have a problem with black business and black entrepreneurship. They don't really understand human motivation or human nature. And they've been feeding from poor students of Karl Marx. I'm going to read this again. Jude says, but in the first order, the Marxian model commits itself to submerging individualism into collectivism, for it is the untrammeled individual who is viewed as driving the capitalist system toward overproduction, boom and bust. The means of production must therefore be owned not by individuals, but by the collection of individuals who compose the state. Now, here's the challenge. This is Cedric talking. To people who say that, it's never really a collective that owns it. It's an elite group. As I say to some folks in Cuba, the people are riding old cars. It's a majority black population. It tends to be lighter skinned Cubans who are running the show, almost like an aristocracy driving Mercedes-Benz. Now, I love Castro. I admire him. But let's not lie. The people don't own everything. The people get a lot of great benefits and they are invested in heavily. But I don't think that the question of ownership has ever been addressed adequately by communists and socialists. They use the rhetoric, but they don't show the instrument. So Jude continues. He says, the Marxian model does not deny that individuals operating in their self-interest bring economic benefits to the whole. It merely argues that a system designed with a fixation on expansion is inherently unstable. This is my beef with certain bad, I call them bad students of Marx. Does Karl Marx really have a problem with what we are calling entrepreneurship? Does he really? Or is it your hang-up? Constant expansion would require individuals to be constantly driven toward accumulation for its own sake. As a miser piles up wealth, and this competition brings boom and bust. What is denied by Karl Marx and other political economists who advance collective models is that there is any natural connection between individual self-interest and economic welfare for all. The connection exists only insofar as human institutions, the state, compel the individual self-interest into channels that do enhance the common good. Now, this is what they're trying to do in Cuba. They're trying to compel and really incentivize smaller private farm owners to produce crops in the best interest of all of Cuba. Hope you all are getting something out of this. All of the Marxian theory rests on the first assumption, this severing of any natural link between self-interest and the commonwealth. If economic self-interest is not necessary to enhance the commonwealth, the design of the Marxian system allows or flows automatically toward human institutions that direct all activities to maximize the commonwealth. It becomes only a matter of reshaping individuals so that they will work for mankind, seeing in this common undertaking the true realization of their self-interests. A friend of mine, somebody just sent me a message. They saw me have a dinner with a student of Karl Marx one night. Anyway, it was funny. I'm looking for some good Marxists, man. I love the writings of Karl Marx. I love Capital. I just can't find good students. I think Karl Marx was smarter than Adam Smith. This is Cedric Muhammad talking. You don't believe me? You want to see my eyes when I say that statement? Hold on. They put the camera on me. Is the camera on? I'm saying I believe Karl Marx was smarter than Adam Smith. This is why I include some of the writings. Take my glasses off. Oh, by the way, one of my viewers in Africa wanted me to take off my glasses. Okay. Karl Marx is smarter than Adam Smith, in my opinion, overall. Both are brilliant. If you're not dealing with the issue of self-interest and the collective commonwealth and how to balance that, whether it's in Islam or whether it's in socialism or capitalism, to me, you're not dealing with the real crux of the economic dilemma. Individual self-interest, economic growth, the redistribution of wealth and the commonwealth, the collective solidarity, the common interest and the self-interest. I deal with that in my book. I have a section where it's a little technical, but I get into Karl Marx's writing on suffering. That's in volume 3. Of the Entrepreneurial Secret. No, I'm sorry. That's in volume 3. Volume 3 of the Entrepreneurial Secret, which deals with the personal struggle, is where I go deep, deep, deep into suffering from psychiatry, psychology, theology, and economics. I quote Karl Marx and talk about his insights on suffering, which Adam Smith did not have. Okay. Let's get to China. What did China do that neither Cuba nor the Soviet Union did? Mao Zedong was a giant in ways that a lot of socialists don't appreciate. Some of them have a problem with him. But to me, the debate is over. China, the Chinese economic model which also revolves around ethnic minority or ethnic middleman trading groups. The Chinese kinship system that allows them to do trade in between nations is fierce. The Jews, the Jewish community and the Chinese community have the illest, I would say, cross-continental trading networks. That's right, the 60th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, standing ovation. Let me explain why. Yeah, standing ovation, China. Okay, let's consult The Way the World Works again. In honor of Mr. Magic, he used to always say, slow it down, Molly. Let him know this ain't a tape. Some of you all may have to slow this down and hit the archives and piece apart what I'm saying. This is the issue. This is the dilemma. This is one of the main reasons why I wrote my book, because people are not being honest about individual self-interest and how to balance that with collective goals and the concept of solidarity in groups. Not being intellectually honest about it, and it's hindering, as well as your view of heaven and hell, it's hindering your ability to do for self, and it's keeping you at a job way over time. Okay, see if you're not following me, ask a question, please. If I don't know, I'll come back next week with an answer. This is so important to get past rhetoric on economic development and wealth creation with groups. That's why I spent so much detailed information. I actually take whole excerpts of what the Jamaican, the Trinidadian community did to build wealth, the Chinese, how they backed entrepreneurs. They did not just save money to buy things. These were not group savings exercises so people could buy nice cars. These were group saving exercises, particularly in the Asian experience, Japanese, Korean, and Chinese, to back entrepreneurs who could not get financing any other way. So I have the evidence and the proof in my book, so we don't have to keep going over rhetoric. You say what the Koreans did, but what exactly did they do? It's in my book. What did the Chinese do? It's in my book. What did the Jamaicans do? It's in my book. Okay, I think I found it. I was just wasting time. Okay, here it goes. Any thoughts on China, Cuba, or the Soviet Union? Let me know. Here we go. Jude Winiski, page 105, The Way the World Works. A good launching pad. The greatest burden to Soviet economic development, and this was written in the late 70s. The greatest burden to Soviet economic development is Soviet agriculture. Of 250 million people in the Soviet Union, roughly 34.3 million are engaged in producing the nation's food, of which there is never enough. The United States, with 220 million, employs only 4.3 million in food production, and these produce a surplus for export that is equivalent to a fourth of all Soviet production. The drain on the Soviet economy is not limited to the low productivity of its farm sector, however, because there are always shortages and because the state does not use the price system to allocate what is available but puts farm goods on the market at regulated prices. Okay, this is Cedric talking. This is the problem with Cuba. Listening to the damn Czech economists, they never got the money right. Soviet citizens spend billions of hours annually waiting on lines. If plentiful food were produced, the Soviets could still allocate via regulated prices in conformance with their ideology. But most of the lines would disappear and the talents and energies of the urban workforce would not be drained in queuing. The source of the problem is the high marginal tax rates exacted on the state's collective farms. Now, this is exactly the problem, or pretty close to the problem in Cuba that you just heard about. The state will provide land, capital, and housing on a collective. It will also permit the workers to keep 10% of the value of their production. The marginal tax rate is thus 90%. In producing food from the land, a small expenditure of effort will produce, say, 100 units of production. It may take twice the effort to yield 150 units of production, and a redoubled effort again to produce 200 units. The workers thus face a progressive tax schedule so withering in its steepness that all incentive to put forth any but the minimum effort is lost. There's no incentive. Under the old Soviet system, there was no incentive for an individual to produce. You're getting taxed at a rate of 90%. By putting in the minimum work, the worker gets land, capital, housing, medical care, and 10 units of the output. By quadrupling his effort, not necessarily physical effort, but merely increasing attentiveness to detail, he will get the same services as before and only 10 more units of output. Meanwhile, the peasants on the collectives are permitted private plots, the entire output of which they are permitted to keep. The tax rate on the private plots is 0% with this result. 27% of the total value of Soviet farm output, about $32.5 billion worth a year, comes from the private plots that occupy less than 1% of the nation's agricultural lands, about 26 million acres. At that rate, private plots are roughly 40 times as efficient as land work collectively. Peasants farm their own plots much more intensively than they do collective land. Ultimately, the communist ideal is to have this last embarrassing but necessary vestige of private enterprise wither away as industrialized state farming grows in scale and output. Nikita Khrushchev, in spite of rural roots, pursued the end vigorously and earned the enmity of the peasantry. He cut the size of private plots to a maximum of half an acre and made life difficult for the farm market trade. I was told by Russian friends that Ukrainian peasants became so irate that they stopped selling eggs as food and made paint out of them. Under Brezhnev, things have improved. This is Leonid Brezhnev. Again, this is the late 70s. The maximum plot went back up to an acre and measures were taken to improve farm market operations. Soviet figures show that the private farm output grew nearly 15% from 1966 to 1973. Now here's what Jude writes about China. He says, the secret of communist China's durability lies in the regressivity of its agricultural income taxation. Only 18% of a base year production is taxed, the first 5% at a 100% rate and the next 13% at a 30% rate. All the grain produced over the base amount is tax-free. With these incentives, communal teams need no private plots to feed the nation's more than 900 million people. No similar incentive system, again, I'm going to say this again, no similar incentive system exists in China's industrial sector, although the new leadership in Peking is moving in that direction. That's still going on. The Chinese were incentivized as individuals and as a collective. That's my point. You can't preach unity and solidarity as a group if you're also not dealing with self-improvement, personal transformation, individual self-interest, and incentivize the person to take risks, to perceive opportunities, and build some type of organization to pursue it. That's a business. That ain't got nothing to do with capitalism, nothing to do with socialism, nothing to do with communism. In my book, I make it clear, a business is a society of people. That's all it is. Who have perceived an idea and are trying to pursue it in an organized fashion. Big, big, big lesson here. You could bring in Islamic economics into the picture.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.